We're going to do the work sessions first so we can get them out of the way.
Yeah.
You ready? House Committee on Revenue for April 6, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to do the work sessions first. If as we get to them, there you find that there are issues that are of difficulty for you, please sing out. We think they're ready. With that, we'll open the work session on House Bill 2128. Kyle, is that yours?
Yeah.
Why don't you give us a reminder explanation?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, House Bill 2128, just to briefly remind everybody, this was a bill that came to us from the assessors, and it was really relating to instances where tax-exempt government owners are leasing property, in which at that time, if it's leased to a taxable owner, it becomes taxable. But when the lease ends, there were cases the assessors brought forward where tax that might still be remaining was not being paid, and since the property is owned by a tax-exempt government owner, if there are any taxes remaining unpaid, there's no way for the tax collector to really collect it. They can't foreclose on the property and sell it or anything along those lines. So this would attempt to correct for that is the idea behind the bill. There is a revenue impact in OLIS. The fiscal impact is minimal. I'll say that first. The revenue impact, it's based upon some data we received from the assessors, and there is some small outstanding amounts, delinquent tax amounts that are out there. And so what I put together here, really, it looks like it's a pretty constant amount, but looking at the data, it is more. These are, there's a few small dollar amounts, but it's the large dollar amounts that can happen here or there that can really move or drive a slight positive revenue impact on being able to actually collect this delinquent tax. So it looks pretty steady in the revenue impact, but more likely there would be years with little to no impact and then a year with maybe a slightly larger impact, but I just averaged it out over the biennium just to give some sense of it, because we can't really predict when a large lease with tax on it will not be paid, that will be paid under this the new law change.
Okay, so this is not a revenue raising bill. It's simply a bill that requires someone to actually be responsible for it in the situation that the real property can't be because of the nature of the relationship.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. And even in some cases, if the tax-exempt owner were to release the property to someone else, there's a chance that these taxes could be paid. But yeah, no, it's not a revenue-raising bill. It's just a change that may yield indirectly in a way.
Okay. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion carries. I'll carry that bill, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2128 and open a work session on House Bill 2129. That's also yours, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, House Bill 2129 was another bill that was brought to us on behalf of the county assessors. We do have the paperwork in order. There's no fiscal, and the revenue impact is minimal. And that's just there's some changes. What the bill does, it allows the assessor to make some changes in maximum assessed value in cases of property that was incorrectly on the roll or in cases where it wasn't picked up originally. So it did exist and the assessors were unaware of it, and then they find it, they can then add it to the roll. So there could be some offsetting components here, but it is a minimal impact.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Yep. Mr. Chair, I had a question on Section 1 I understood because it was driven in Section 2, in Section 1, Paragraph 1 and Paragraph 2, I understood because they are driven by the petitioner, by the petitioner demonstrating.
Right.
Then down in 3A, in Section 1, it was a correction under Sub 2A of this. And I guess my question was this just a restating of what already existed, or was there something else going on with that? In other words, what we're trying to figure out here is can the assessor increase the tax without a prompting from the owner?
Representative Benz, if the assessor discovered property that wasn't currently being taxed, and I think we had some testimony on this as well, and they hadn't looked at it before, so the burden would be on them to prove that it hasn't been picked up as part of the tax account in the past, then they could bring that under. So if there's square footage or something that wasn't captured or an addition. But in the cases where it's an incorrect or say the assessor has it listed at 2,800 square feet and really the property is 2,600, that's where the property owner would petition and see that reduction.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
So we're trying to. So the issue is, can the assessor increase? If it's a matter of decreasing, then we're okay with it. If it's a matter of increasing, then we're not so much okay, unless it's the petitioner requests. So is that what you're saying, that this would be a decrease only, a reduction in?
For the entire bill?
No, just section, just 3A.
Yeah, in that first part, yeah, that's related to the decrease, yes.
Okay, that's fine then.
All right, and the rest of it is simply a restatement of what was already the law, isn't it?
I believe there is some clarification on how the property would be added to making sure the value is before. I think there's a formulaic where this is more, you actually put it on at the value of the missing property, not just the square footage amount as
right,
a percentage.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's consistent with the bill we passed several weeks ago, so it's fine.
Right. Okay. Representative Bent?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2129 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2129 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I just want to make clear that it is only by petition of the home or property owner that the taxes can be increased. The property.
Reassessment.
The assessment, excuse me, which would lead to an increased property tax.
Representative, if there's new property that's been discovered that hasn't been picked up on the roll, in that case, it could be added. But if someone petitions, it would be for the decrease.
So say you take an existing structure and somehow it comes to the attention of the assessor that it is assessed incorrectly. That it's too low. Can the assessor go in without a petition of the owner I'm just trying to figure out if where the petition applies. Is it everything that we're looking at?
Representative, it would really be if they discovered something that wasn't on the roll. It's not just we think this should be valued differently, so we'll adjust MAV or something along those lines. But it's more if there was, say, an addition that wasn't originally picked up. So if the house expanded or they had an addition and the assessor was unaware of it at the time, and then they discovered a few years later or something to that effect. But it's not about revaluing existing property. It'd be about the discovery of really new property and putting it
okay.
on there.
Okay.
Right. It doesn't actually change the law. It really just clarifies what the assessor can do, isn't it?
It changes a little bit how they would address things.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Did you make the motion?
I did.
You did. All right. Representative Bentz moved House Bill 2129 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Any objection to the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Davis.
I'm going to take a little further look at this bill, so for now I'll be a no.
All right. Representative, let's call the roll then, shall we?
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Johnson?
All right.
Representative Leininger?
Yes.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Baker Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bentz?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Did you call everyone?
I'm sorry.
I'm going to be a no right now also.
All right. With that, the motion carries, and the who is very, very, very interested in carrying this bill. if no one is, Representative Bentz has indicated he'll carry it. And that's what we will do. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2129 and open a work session on House Bill 2131. Mazin's on this one. Okay.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2131, just to refresh your memory, this is the one that was brought to you by MDEC, the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, where they suggest changes in the bonding laws for the local governments to add the levy language and the lien language into the statutes. And you had testimony about these changes as one being not very substantive. That's from the MDEC, but the bonding, but the debt office of the state treasurer also testified that this pushes the ratings by about half a notch on the bonds.
It saves us some money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, improves the bonding quality.
Quality, yes. Discussion? Representative Benz?
Chair, I move House Bill 2131 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves House Bill 2131 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? With that, the motion carries. Who would like to carry this bill? Representative Benz, will carry.
I'll give my vice chair a little.
Representative Vega Peterson will carry. We'll spread them around a little.
Yeah.
Representative Vega Peterson will carry, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2131, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2148. Colleagues, the city's asked to be heard on this one briefly, so as soon as we've gotten the overview, we'll hear from Wendy Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2148 would formally exempt permanent improvements that are located on federal land held in trust for federally recognized Indian tribes or tribe members from state and local properties taxes, fees, charges, and assessments. The A version incorporates the amendments that would make the types of tax exempt, it would expand it to fees and charges as well as just property taxes. And so that clarification is in there. It is found that the measure has no fiscal impact and also no revenue impact. This is due to there's available in OLIS an opinion from Legislative Council that these properties are most likely already exempt from property taxation, and so this this measure would be a formalization of that.
Very good. Please.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Wendy Johnson with the League of Oregon Cities. I missed the hearing on this bill, and our cities are concerned about unintended consequences with this bill. We support the bill, but we just want to put on the record. We got a -2 amendment in the Rural Committee on Land Use and Water. We just added the words related to property taxation. That's on line 20 of the amended bill as you have it. This is coming out of the Great Wolf Lodge case and the fact that that case held that you can't tax you can't provide property taxes on the tribal land, but there are also other fees associated with the property taxes. So the Department of Revenue wanted to make sure to catch all of those property tax related fees, but there are other fees imposed on property, stormwater fees and such. And so we wanted to make sure that the record is clear that we're talking about only fees associated with property taxes, not other fees, including stormwater fees. So cities would still be able to collect that. It's an important issue because it's being litigated across the country on whether stormwater fees are fees or taxes. And in Oregon, we've treated them as fees, and we don't want to unintentionally loop all of this in and preempt cities and counties from assessing other fees. So we've added that extra language of related to property taxation. We just want to put it on the record of that's why. And just thank you for your support.
Very good. Any questions for Wendy? Do you think the bill does not prevent you from collecting stormwater fees and things of that sort where you're providing a direct service?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, we think the amendment takes care of it, but cities are still freaking out about the issue, and so they asked me to make it clear on the record for any appellate decisions that that extra phrase is meant to keep it limited, that we're only talking about fees associated with property taxes, not other types
other
of
things.
Fees.
Yes, because you provide services.
Correct.
For a variety of different kinds of businesses, and there are fees attached to those services.
Correct.
that are direct fees related to the provision of the service itself, rather than property taxes, which, of course, go to a whole bunch of other things.
Correct.
Right.
Chair Barnhart, the language comes directly from federal statute, and so that language has been interpreted, but our courts will interpret it as the plain words are, and so we need to make sure we limit it to only property tax-related fees.
For themselves. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2148A to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves House Bill 2148A to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Whitsitt?
I'll be a no on this bill. Okay. I think there's not enough clarity, and it hasn't been determined by the courts yet in the state, so I'm no on the fees.
Thank you. Representative Benz, please.
Mr. Chair, I'll be yes on the bill, and that's after I spoke with Alan Dale at length about the content of the bill, and I think the bill has been crafted correctly, consistent with the law, although, indeed, there could be room for further judicial interpretation. But the comment I made earlier about this situation stands, and that is that where we have these difference in tax structures and tax policies, one on the one side of the independent dependent nation, that is a reservation slash trust land, and the state on the other, all this will do is drive folks that aren't on trust land to ask us for the same kind of tax treatment outside the trust land. And so I'm anxious to see how that's going to play out, if that's the right word. The law is the law, at least as we understand it at this point, so yes.
The policy of the federal government and the treaty establishes that, and we're stuck with it.
We are.
I think it's another way of saying the same thing.
Right.
All right.
Exactly.
Thank you. Other discussion? Is there any? I think we better call the roll again because we have at least one no.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Reed, I'm sorry.
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
No.
Vice Chair Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. And with that, the motion carries, and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Does someone want to carry that bill?
I'll take it.
Representative Davis will carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2148 and open a work session on House Bill 3001. And Kyle is back. We should have put these in a different order, shouldn't we? Lots of running around.
So, yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3001, with the -1 amendment, we do have the paperwork, both the fiscal and the revenue with the amendment included. And it relates to property tax destroyed or damaged property and changing the time to apply for that, moving it from July 1st to December 31st, and then the amendment adds in a late filing fee if someone files late for the assessor, a $200 fee.
All right. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3001 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 3001 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Sorry? Do we have an amendment?
We do.
We have an amendment. We better look at the amendment before we vote on this thing.
I withdraw my motion.
Okay. Well, I don't know that you have to do that, but let's discuss the amendment, please.
Yes, so Mr. Chair, it was the amendment. Really, it requires a late filing fee.
That's the filing fee piece.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that was the incentive for getting the filing done on time. If you get it done on time, you don't have to pay the late filing fee. If you don't get it done on time, you have to pay the late filing fee.
Right, and part of the issue was people sometimes don't realize that this is available to them until they get the bill and their property's been destroyed. Mm-hmm. So this would allow them to be able to go ahead and file on this because there's a fair amount of paperwork that goes along with it. The late filing fee is included in a number of other provisions as well.
So ignorance costs $200 or 0.1% of the real market value.
Mm-hmm.
If this is, yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, is the 0.1% of real market value, is that elsewhere in statute as well? Do we know? In terms of how high that value may be.
Davis, I believe this is, yeah, the carbon, kind of the carbon copy of what's in statute okay. for all the late filing.
Thank you.
This is simply applying the same rule that we have in other places.
Yes, for, yep. for a number of different, yes.
Okay. So, shall we start over?
Sure.
Representative Betts.
Mr. Chair, I'm withdrawing my previous motion. I move House Bill, the amendment to House Bill 3001-1.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 3001. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Bentz.
Chair, I move House Bill 3001 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves House Bill 3001 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is carried. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Is this one that could go on the consent calendar?
I don't,
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, I don't think so. I think Representative Esquivel may want an opportunity to tell the story of this affected property tax owner on the floor.
Yeah.
Is this his bill?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll ask him to carry it then. And if he doesn't want to carry it, then I'll come back and talk to you. Representative Esquivel will carry it. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3001 and recognize Representative Vega Peterson for a motion to suspend the rules.
Chair Barnhart, I move we suspend the rules to allow Representative Reed, Representative Davis to vote on House Bill 2128.
And Representative Leininger.
And anyone else who needs to vote.
to vote on which bill?
House Bill 2128.
That's the one that they missed, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Vega Peterson moves that the rules be suspended to allow the three representatives to vote on House Bill 2128. Is there any objection to the motion to suspend the rules? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Let's see. Who do I need? Representative Leininger, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
And who else? Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Reed, all three voted aye. With that, we will reclose the work session on House Bill 2128. And was there any? Did you miss any other votes? I think everybody was here by the time we got to the second one. Thank you all. 2129. All right. So we'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2129.
Yes.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Oh, you already opened it. So I was going to move to suspend the rules, but you
can. Well, we need to do that to allow someone to vote.
I move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Reed to vote on House Bill 2129.
Okay, Representative Vega Peterson moves to suspend the rules to allow Representative Reed to vote on House Bill 2129. Any objection to the motion to suspend the rules? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Reed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Reed votes aye. With that, we'll reclose the work session on House Bill 2129. Colleagues, thank you so much. We have been holding these bills over every day for the last week. We finally get them out and get them to the floor and off to the Senate. And with that, we'll go on to our public hearings. Okay, these bills are on essentially the same topic, aren't they? There's no reason why I can't open them at once, is there? All right, so we'll open the public hearings on House Bill 2074 and House Bill 2134. Kyle.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, you'll find these two bills to be oddly identical. So if it's okay with you, I'll just do one description for the two.
Please.
Okay. So the two House Bills 2074 and 2134 would expand the definition of tobacco products for the purpose of taxation to include vapor products. Defines vapor products as electronic device designed to heat nicotine solutions or other solutions for the purpose of producing a vapor to be inhaled by user of the device or a nicotine solution in any form to be used with an electronic device as described. It applies to distributions of tobacco products occurring on or after January 1st, 2016.
Thank you very much. And so we'll hear from Wendy Johnson and Gil Reddell first. And we have quite a few people to come, so work hard to be brief in your testimony. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson with the League of Oregon Cities. I'm testifying today in support of both of these bills, but with amendments. You should have on OLIS a bunch of materials submitted by me earlier today that kind of walk through some of the points. Oregon does not presently regulate nor tax vaping products, and this bill would tax vaping products, but the way it does not actually provide a revenue stream to local government. So that's our concern with the bill, sort of the initial premise. If you're able to bring up my testimony on the screen, that would be helpful. There are, by my count, at least five really important bills on vaping that sort of lay out the big picture. Senate Bill 190 is still in the Senate, and it was heard in the Judiciary Committee, and it would prohibit internet sales of all tobacco products and cigarettes, and then also electronic cigarettes. So as you see on the screen, that bill uses the term electronic cigarettes. And then you have the two bills in front of you today, House Bill 2134 and House Bill 2074. Those two bills use the term vapor products and would tax both. In both bills, they would tax vapor products. So you see a different term. And the way the bills are written that you have before you today, those would be at 65% of the wholesale cost of the vapor products. And then House Bill 3053 is another one that's sitting in your committee. It uses the term vapor products as well. It would tax it at 81.25% of wholesale. And then if you go to the next page, a bill that's already passed out of the House I think it was 56 votes in favor, is House Bill 2546. And that's the one that regulates vaping products, but it uses the term inhalant delivery system. And it covers nicotine or cannabinoids, both of those substances. So my first concern is that if you are going to tax vaping products, that we need to be consistent in which term you use. And since you've already passed the first one out of the House, the House Bill 2546, and it looks like there's been those were in your health committees and such, so those were bills that I did not track, but you've worked on those definitions and which products to cover, because you regulated the sale of those to minors and such. You regulated both the product and the delivery system and the attachments and all those things. So it just makes sense to use those same terms if you're going to tax, and then also use the same definitions. There's a little note at the very bottom of this page. Washington has two bills pending. House Bill 2211 would tax vaping products at 60%, plus they have a sales tax. And then they have House Bill 1645, which is a 95%, plus their sales tax. So whichever way you choose, just to keep in mind that border issue and how that works. The next page in the materials I submitted lays out the taxing distribution up in the upper right corner. Local government only receives tax distributions on cigarette sales, not on other tobacco. So nothing on cigars or snuff or that other whole long list of products. And so it's really only two buckets in the law right now for tobacco products, and cities and counties only receive a tax shared revenue stream if it's a cigarette. And so even though everybody calls these vaping products e-cigarettes, the way the bill is written, it puts it in the list of other tobacco products. So we would not receive any share, even though the cities would be responsible in large part for regulating and enforcing these laws. So we'd ask that that be changed in the bill. I think it's also important just to look at that chart in the upper right. You'll see that it's 2 cents. That's how much cities get on the cigarette tax. It's $1.31 for a pack of cigarettes right now, and the share that cities receive is 2 cents. It started out in 1966 at 1 cent for cities, 1 cent for counties, and the other 2 cents went to the state. So we literally had 25% of the share, and now we're at just over 1%. So we would prefer that you not use the cigarette distribution method, because again, that's going to provide almost very little revenue stream to cities. And then obviously if you use the other tobacco, there's none. So that with other tobacco, there's the three distributees, the general fund, the health plan, and the TURA, the tobacco use reduction account. It's distributed over a much bigger group of entities in the cigarette tax distribution because you have mental health as well, and then elderly with the Department of Transportation. So those are the two buckets right now. On the next slide, the way the cigarette tax revenues work is that it's a distribution over all of the cities by per capita. And so for the 14-15, it's $1.25 per person in your city. That's how much is distributed, because the question is always, well, how does that work? I just threw that in so you'll understand how that it works right now. But you'll see that it's decreasing each year, the share that goes to cities, because cigarette consumption is going down. The next slide is just the population chart. Portland State releases that each year, and that's what it's, the official distribution is based on, is the population chart. The next slide is the total disbursements, the actual, and then the projected. Again, you'll see that for the next year, the 15-16, we're looking at $3.2 million. You know, those numbers used to be well over $6 or $7 million in the past, and now it just keeps getting less and less because, as I said, our percent is so small and cigarette consumption is going down. And there's been, I think I've said it before this committee many times, that 60% of our revenue comes from property tax and the rest comes from some mishmash of fees, but we really have not been able to backfill any of the lost revenues over the years, and the shared revenue numbers just keep going down. So we would like to, since cigarette consumption is being often replaced with vaping, we'd like to be back in that shared revenue. The next slide just shows how much the state does receive in cigarette tax and other tobacco. You see the negative 15.8 on the cigarette tax, that as a state we're, that number just keeps going down. But you'll see other tobacco is going up, and when you look at vaping products, those numbers are going up exponentially as well. So since we're in the other tobacco bucket right now, we would get zero. And so we want to be a part of the part that's going up. The next slide is a little bit dated from the Department of Revenue. I think it's from 2008 or 2009. But it does show you just tiny, a little, the white and the yellow. The white is the city and the yellow is the county. Just shows you what that percent really looks like visually. But it also, the little, shows you that in 1966 we were at 4 cents a pack and how we've gone to $1.31 now. And the next slide shows the cigarette tax compared to the, along with the other tobacco. And again, it just shows you the local is that little yellow line. It's the next slide. Yeah, so just that little top is the percent that goes to local government right now of, as a total of all the taxes for tobacco and cigarette. The next two slides are slides that I took from Dr. Warner's presentation that he gave to the Senate on property tax reform and just revenue reform. We just do not have a very diverse tax base for local government, and because we're so property tax heavy and we don't have a sales tax. So this was his depiction of that problem. If we can boost up our other shared revenue, including the excise taxes, it will help balance out cities, especially when there's such volatility with property taxes in the down economies times. The next slide is another one from another, just one slide from Dr. Warner's presentation, just shows that the negative problem with our system is that we have that lack of diversity and it's rigid and it has some inequities and such. So I know both your committee and the Senate committee are looking at tax reform, and these just slides help point out that problem. The next slide is just the comparison of what the tax rates are for cigarettes in all of the states. And then I pointed out Washington, California, and Idaho, just so you have that background information. And then the last document is a Wells Fargo research report that a lot of people are citing of just what the growth of the vaping industry is looking at forward. And so I just want to make that a part of the record. I think there are really three issues that I can narrow it down that this committee needs to grapple with. The what are you going to tax, looking at the terms and the components. The how much, it doesn't work exactly like cigarettes of per cigarette. You're going to have to look at probably the wholesale issue and the cost. But again, how much, you have a couple of bills. One is 60-some percent, the other is 80-something, and Washington's grappling with those numbers too. So the what, how much, and then who would receive the distribution of the shares. I think those are the three big issues to deal with if you're going to tax. Oregon statute preempts local governments from taxing tobacco or cigarettes. That's in ORS 323-030 and 323-640. There's another bill in the Senate that would lift that preemption, so local governments could choose to tax at a local option. We would support that as well, but I know industry does not, and so that's just to point out the obvious that we have no control over it. It really, the way the statutes are written right now, we cannot tax on our own, even though it's an issue for health as well as not knowing, especially as we look at cannabinoids, of not knowing what a product is. There are the five bills that you need to take a look at, and we just would ask that it be a meaningful share. Another option, so there's not so much administrative work, instead of putting it in the cigarette tax bucket or the other with nothing, would be to use the marijuana tax bill. There's not an official bill number yet, but as many of you know, with Measure 90, there's work being done to provide a tax on marijuana and then a distribution back to local government. So you could use that distribution method so that it would, whatever that percentage is, which I've heard to be as high as 10 to 15%, then that it would actually provide a meaningful share back to local government and not provide another administrative headache and another set of rules. It would just be in the same distribution. That makes sense for a couple of reasons. Also, because the bill that you've already passed included both nicotine and cannabinoids in the regulation, so to tax using those same terms and using the same method would work. So that's kind of my quick synopsis of what I see the situation is, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Wendy's covered the map here. I have I was able at the last moment to submit a one-page bit of testimony that I guess did get in your on OLAS, thanks to your staff. I just want to point out just a couple of things, add to what Wendy said, and I wanted to address it in the context of the state-county shared services and revenues relationship that's developed over time. We have several agreements with you as counties, and often the agreement was the counties gave up some authority to tax or to regulate in exchange for a share of revenues for the state doing that job. This has worked well sometimes, but unfortunately it hasn't worked perfectly all the time. These agreements are forgotten, and the cigarette tax is an example of a partnership left behind. It was the 1965 Legislative Assembly that needed the cities and counties' support to refer successfully a cigarette tax to the voters. What the cities and counties gave up was authority to preempt local, compensation for that part of the tax that we were to get, the 50-50 share that Wendy referred to, and that would be a 2 cents to the state, a penny to cities, a penny to counties per pack, was in compensation for preempting the local taxing authority. Since then, there's been a lot of increase in the cigarette tax. It's gone to very worthy purposes. It's hard to argue about the Oregon Health Plan and elderly transportation. But our original 25% as counties has shrunk to 1.8%. So we ask if there are new resources available by growth in tobacco products, or as you define them, we hope the legislature steers its direction of revenue sharing back toward the original understanding. That's it for me. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Bass?
No.
Oh, I thought you were telling me you did. I had a couple. Would you provide for us the amendments you're proposing for this bill?
Chair,
I understand the issue that you raised having to do with consistency of terms. I don't know that I understood anything else you were suggesting, but that would be helpful if we could have that in a little more specific form in writing. That would be helpful. The other thing I'm wondering about is, as you point out, we've preempted local governments from having a tax on cigarette and other tobacco products. Is it your view that this also applies to vaping, e-cigarettes, that kind of thing? Because everyone else tells me, at least, that they're not the same thing as tobacco products or cigarettes.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, with respect to the amendments, I think some of them are policy issues, but if you're just asking for a straight across, you know, use the same terms that were used in House Bill 2546, I'd be happy to work with Ledge Council on that.
But you did propose some policy changes, and it'd be useful to have those in writing, too.
Sure. I think mostly it's on what the revenue or what
right.
What you want the tax to be, and then working with the marijuana tax as that work group continues to work. I'd be happy to help coordinate that. With respect to the vaping tax, I think it's a good question. Arguably, cities and counties are permitted to tax that product right now. It's a bit of a murky area because it is not totally defined. Because the state has preempted on tobacco and other products, it makes sense to make that clear now. But I think you're right. We could tax right now.
Do either of these bills establish that preemption?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I do not believe so.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I have a bunch of people who've indicated they're here in opposition. One person indicates he's more than 100 miles from home, actually two. So I'm going to call them first, and then we'll go down the list. I'm going to ask people to be succinct and direct. And if the point's already been made, you might skip it. Kelly Lovelace, Tim Churchill, both indicate they're more than 100. Wait a minute. Am I got that right? Yes, more than 100 miles from home. Why don't you come up forward, please, and... Mr. Churchill, and then how about Will Krause, who's first on the list, to join them.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Go ahead, whoever wants to go first.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Chair Barnhart.
State your name for the record, please, and then give your testimony.
My name is Tim Churchill. I'm from Medford, and I work with EC Blend. We are the largest e-liquid manufacturer in Oregon. We also sell throughout the United States and through 14 different international countries. We are in opposition to the tax bills proposed today, the 2074 and the 2134. With projections from our company growth and plans for growth, we would be adding over 200 employees within the next 2 years to keep up with our current business plan. Not only do we oppose this tax, we are also concerned, greatly concerned, that this tax will deter people switching from smoking to vaping or quitting altogether. Vaping products are not actually tobacco. This is new technology for a lot of us with the vaping. It helps people quit smoking, and it also is an alternative for people that smoke. And in some areas, it is more commonly used for people to quit smoking. We do not feel that this tax should be on our product, either the e-liquid or the e-cigarettes. There is a huge harm reduction possibilities surrounding this product. If you were to tax these vapor products and e-cigarettes, you would be killing Oregon jobs. Hundreds of jobs would be lost. Hundreds of dollars would go to internet sales and possibly sales overseas. Oregon businesses would be forced to make a choice either to close or to leave Oregon. And worse yet, would possibly keep smokers from having the choice, the opportunity to quit smoking because of the extra costs on this product. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lovelace? Wow.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and committee, my name is Kelly Lovelace. I live in South Lane County, and I'm involved at some level in a vape business. I am also very opposed to this tax. I think it's very unfair. And the previous speaker is exactly right. There are a tremendous amount of people using this product to quit smoking cigarettes and eventually get completely away even from the nicotine. And I don't know of your experience with it as much, but certainly I've seen it a great deal. People are getting rid of cigarettes and going to vaping and doing better, absolutely. The other thing is I'm not sure that we ought to be taxing any of these new businesses. Probably the best thing we could do is spend less money in the state. And if we really wanted to tax, I was down in the restaurant down below, and I see salt, I see sugar, I see soda pop. These are all things that are causing great health risk to a great many people. And then as I walked around the Capitol, I see a lot of people overweight. Let's just weigh everybody and tax them at a certain rate for being overweight. I mean, those are real issues that we could do something about. And if you're weighing too much money, 50 pounds, you might lose weight. So those are some thoughts. I certainly think that taxing this particular product is not what needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Krause, please.
Chairman Barnhart, committee members, I have a presentation here that I would like to go through with you, and I'll go through it as quickly as I can. I am president of the Northwest Vapor Association, which is an association of electronic cigarette vapor product manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, and users throughout the state of Oregon. And what I want to look at here are the fallacies and dangers of taxing e-cigarettes to replace the lost revenue from cigarette sales. First of all, as has been stated, e-cigarettes are not tobacco products. Taxing e-cigarettes will drive sales to the internet and the black market, which will put many businesses out of business. Various accessories and attachments for e-cigarettes are sold separately. As such, they don't fit the description of vaping product in this bill, in these bills. E-cigarette tax won't even come close to covering what's lost in the cigarette tax revenue. And this bill is unfairly picking on the e-cigarette industry. I'd like to go into each of those in a little more detail. E-cigarettes do not contain tobacco, but they do contain nicotine. Gum, patches, they contain nicotine, but they aren't considered tobacco products. Many of the Solanaceae, or nightshade family of plants, contain nicotine, including potato, tomato, egg, or potato and tomato if you prefer, eggplant, and petunia. They're not considered tobacco products. In fact, a recent study has shown that by simply touching the leaf of a tobacco plant, you ingest more nicotine than you would ingest from secondhand vapor from an electronic cigarette. Now, even though e-cigarettes may contain nicotine, they are not tobacco products, and that is a very strong position for us. Secondly, taxing e-cigarettes will drive business down to the internet and cause businesses in Oregon to close down. Let me give you an example. The cost of a 10-ml bottle of e-liquid in stores is about $5.60, depending on where you go. With a proposed tax, that would be increased to about $7.05 a bottle. The cost of the same 10-ml bottle of Chinese e-liquid online is about $3, plus an average of about $1 per bottle for shipping, for a total of about $4 per bottle. So you can see now our price difference is noticeable, but not as significant as it would be with this tax. This will drive sales from our local stores to the internet, thus losing our businesses and jobs in Oregon. In addition, the black market of e-liquid sales being sold on Amazon, Facebook, eBay, as well as on the streets, quite literally, will soar. You can ignore that last point because I understand this bill does not tax current inventory as the Washington bill does. Next, much of the e-cigarette sales are for attachments and accessories not covered by this tax. Both these House bills define a vapor product as an electronic device designed to heat nicotine solutions and other solutions for the purpose of producing vapor to be inhaled by the user of the device. Many of the products that we sell in our stores don't fit this definition. For instance, the battery in this vaping device right here is what powers this flashlight. So are you going to tax a battery because it can be used in a vaping device? Other things that by themselves don't fit this description include cases, lanyards, drip tips, cartomizers, atomizer heads, mechanical mods, box mods, Canthal wire, wicking material, RDAs, chargers, and charging accessories. And there are even more things that I finally cut off the list there. The key here is that e-liquid sales account for a majority of our e-liquid revenue. And here's why that's important. The Oregon cigarette tax is 65% of the wholesale price. That's about $1.30. It's $1.31, which, as you probably know, is due to go up in January of 2016 to $1.32. A 10-mil bottle of e-liquid wholesales for about $2.50. At a 65% tax rate, that equates to about $1.62 tax per 10-mil bottle. Now, vaping a 10-mil bottle is equivalent, roughly, to smoking six packs of cigarettes. Six packs of cigarettes, that's $8.70 in tax. One 10-mil bottle of e-liquid, that's $1.62 in tax. So the tax on the e-cigarettes will collect less than one-fifth of the revenue that's lost due to reduced cigarette sales. The loss of business resulting from this tax will reduce business tax revenue and personal income tax revenue as well. So, in summary, it says it's a bad tax that won't accomplish its intended purpose. Now, finally, this is picking on the vaping industry. Tobacco tax is a sin tax. A number of recent studies have shown that e-cigarettes are not nearly as harmful and deadly as tobacco. Even the American Heart Association says the use of e-cigarettes in those unable or unwilling to quit cigarettes should be supported rather than discouraged. And I give you a link there of where I got that. Just because they're an alternative to cigarettes doesn't mean they should be taxed in their place. This tax only really benefits big tobacco by making their unhealthy product look more attractive. We'd be better off with another sin tax, like a tax on unhealthy soft drinks, which California is already doing, or junk food. The original justification for the cigarette tax was to discourage the use of cigarettes. Now that cigarette use is on the decline, do we really want to drive people back to smoking cigarettes? That's what this tax will do. So in conclusion, these bills will cost Oregon jobs, prevent some people from choosing a healthy alternative to deadly cigarettes, and will not even come close to accomplishing the intended purpose of replacing lost cigarette tax revenue.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony very much. James Wright, Tim Schultz, Ron, I think it's Sather. Sather, thank you.
Chairman Barnhart, thank you for letting me speak today. I'm Tim Schultz. I manage a couple of vape shops in Multnomah County and Washington County. A lot's already been said, so I'll just kind of try and hit some target points. One thing, in my opinion, is that this tax actually rewards tobacco, partially because of the way that it is assigned. Devices were a big topic before. But just like in tobacco, you don't tax lighters, you don't tax pipes, you don't tax anything that's used besides the tobacco itself. And I can tell you that if this thing happens, all my businesses are going to pack up and go right over to Vancouver. I know there's been the League of Cities talked about the Washington tax. We've been very heavily involved in that as well, and I can tell you with some certainty that bill, both of those bills are dead. That's not going to happen in Washington. And if you do this with all the businesses that are in Multnomah County and Washington County, we are all just going to go on the other side of the river. We're out of here. And there's a lot of revenue for the state, but you're going to lose that I don't think is going to be replaced by the tobacco tax. So this is kind of a win for tobacco in that regard, because we're being doubly punished. We're taxing the liquid and we're taxing the devices as well. It makes you're taxing both parts of it and increases the tax burden to the user. And again, for something that we do believe it is a great health harm reduction and actually is going to save you your bottom line on medical costs and Medicaid costs down the road. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Representative Barnhart, Chair and committee members, my name is Ron Sather. I'm a voter out of District 15 and also a shop owner here locally. Most of the owners in this industry are small business. We've invested our life savings in order to help promote a product that we used ourselves that has helped us get off away from tobacco and big tobacco. Personally, I haven't had a cigarette in a year and a half. I feel 100% better than I did then after smoking for 35 years. I really see this as being a huge help in quitting. I've tried several other things. The majority of us have been in business for under 2 years. You know, we're scrimping and saving, putting in long hours, and trying to reinvest everything that we can into our companies to make them successful. Imposing a 65% tax at this point, especially if you're going back and doing current inventory, would absolutely kill my business. I would have to shut my doors. At minimum, if you do not do back inventory, I'm not sure exactly how this is going to play out, I would at minimum have to be laying off employees. So you're going to be losing jobs and revenue, and I really don't see that the taxes are going to compensate for your loss of revenue in that respect. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Senator Bernhardt, my name is James Wright. I am the lab manager for Vape Right. It was a local vape shop in Kaiser, Oregon. I believe I'm the smallest entity that's represented here. I don't even have employees. I have myself, my wife, and my father-in-law. That's it. And the occasional customer who works for, you know, a couple hours every day while I go to lunch. The tax would just, I'm not sure on what the wording is for back inventory. But I mean, yeah, we'd basically close our doors. And I mean, the three of us have invested around $40,000 to start this business. I scrimp save, everything. We opened our shop the day after State Fair last year, September 2nd. We actually had a booth at the fair. We make enough to, we're self-sufficient after, 8 months, 9 months. For the shop, and we basically pay all our bills and that's it. We buy product, we pay bills and that's it. There's no extra spending money, there's nothing. This tax, we would have to not only increase our prices from wholesale, we would have to increase our customer prices. So, and our customers are going to go, maybe I really don't want to pay all this. I'll just go buy a pack of cigarettes. So there's that. I've put literally blood, sweat, and tears into the business that we've owned. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony very much. David Glenn, Joseph Gilpatrick, Matt Evans, please.
Hi, my name is David Glenn. I am a partner of Fat Boy Vapors. We have a store in Gresham, Oregon, which is Multnomah County. We also have stores in Alaska, California, and one in Vancouver, Washington. Right now, as I see it, with consumers' average spending on vaping, they used it to get off of cigarettes. They're averaging about $1,800 a year. That's what they spend. You add the tax onto this, it's going to put them over $27,000 to $3,000 in average spending that they're going to do on taxes. The average consumer of a pack a day on cigarettes is about $2,700 annually. Without that additional tax on cigarettes, you're going to make vaping more expensive, and that all comes down to how you end up interpreting and deciding which products you're going to actually tax when it comes to vaping. As I interpreted the language on it, and I don't know if I can get clarification on that, but it looked to me like there was going to be a tax on the current inventory in stock in the stores once the tax goes into effect. If that's not the case, it's great. Okay. If it does, I've got $60,000 worth of inventory. That's $36,000 in tax I have to pay all in one lump bill. I'm bankrupt. I'm not going to keep my store open, and that's we don't have the money for that. We may have more than one chain in stores, but we're smaller. Regardless of whether or not that inventory on the tax occurs, or the tax on the inventory occurs, I'm going to lose revenue if this tax goes into place. Vapers already are an elusive group to maintain as a consumer. They go online, where all the vape locations that are selling are typically more expensive than online already. We're usually 15 to 20% more expensive in our stores than the same products would be online. It's the only way we can do it. A lot of these are coming from cheap products. They're coming out of China and other local manufacturers. Stores buy them wholesale, sell them online pretty cheap, especially from out of state. We can't compete with that. And right now we offer services in our shop to try to bring people in as it is. You add this additional tax on there, we're now not just we're not going to be able to compete. My store in Hazeldale will get all the refugee dollars from Oregon because that's where all the customers are going to go. You got the greatest concentration of vape retailers in Multnomah County. They're all 20 minutes away from Vancouver. You're already getting a 48% bleed rate from Washington and Oregon on your tobacco. You guys know that there's that crossover. You're going to create the exact flip. It's now going to cross over to Vancouver. My shop in Vancouver is poised to receive that revenue. However, I don't care to lose my store in Oregon to get it. And you have more stores in Multnomah County than the rest of the state combined. That's how big of a market it is right there on the border with Washington. You're going to have the same problem going over to Idaho. Idaho is not imposing these kind of taxes. You're going to lose all your revenue on the border there, too. Washington's tax bills for that 65 and 95%, you're not going to see those happen. We're putting up a pretty good fight in Washington on those, and I don't believe those are going to go through. So you guys are going to be way out of balance by putting the 65% tax here on Oregon consumers when they're just going to go online. That's really the bulk of my testimony here. You do this, the shops close, you lose the revenue. The revenue that would be generated is now going to go online or into my store in Vancouver. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
My name is Joseph Gilpatrick. I'm a retail shop owner in Lebanon, Oregon. I've been in business a little over a year now. I was a 22-year smoker. When I found these products, they helped me to quit smoking cigarettes personally. I now vape zero nicotine. So I still use the products, but they are zero nicotine, so just for a placebo effect as far as for the hand and mouth. I'm, like I said, a shop owner in a very small town, and I see firsthand how this affects our public. You know, I've asked, you know, in the last month, my customers to sign the wall if they've quit smoking cigarettes completely with a vaporizer, and to be honest about it. And in the last 2.5 weeks, I've had 120 signatures in Lebanon. That's a very small town. A lot of people are proud not to be tobacco users and to be classified as tobacco as such and be outcast again. You know, as a cigarette smoker, you know, I've been ridiculed. It's been okay by our society to tell a smoker they stink. It's okay to tell a smoker, you know, just rude things. And, you know, and cigarette smokers found this as an alternative that makes them feel better. That, you know, for myself personally, as my testimony, makes me feel better. I can jog up to 10 miles and I feel great about it. And I believe in these products and so do hundreds of thousands of other Americans. There's over 100 vape shops in Oregon. That's over 2,000 Oregon jobs. And these taxes are jeopardizing all of that. So please consider these things before you make this decision. And that's all I have for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I'm a resident of Raleigh Hills, Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. If one of your goals as a legislator is to see the number of people in Oregon who smoke cigarettes be reduced, then you should vote no on HB 2074 and HB 2134. You've heard personal testimony. There's other testimony from Oregon and nationally that cigarette smokers are adopting vape products, including electronic cigarettes, so to speak, in order to help them wean themselves off of tobacco products. That is something we should be encouraging, not discouraging, if we want to have an impact on the health of our citizens. Perhaps more importantly, there's a recent study that came out from State Budget Solutions using data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that showed that broader adoption of electronic cigarette use would lead to massive savings in particularly the Medicaid program going forward. And I've provided a copy of this. I believe it's already up on OLIS for you to take a look at.
It is, yes.
In Oregon, the estimate is that 67% of all Medicaid recipients are also tobacco users, smokers. If we can encourage those folks to wean themselves off of tobacco products and onto electronic cigarettes or vape products, we will dramatically reduce the amount of money that Oregon has to spend on its Medicaid program in the years to come. Now, this is not going to happen tomorrow, although we know that stopping smoking does provide almost immediate health benefits. However, it will happen. It's an opportunity for you to be far-reaching and far-looking and not tax these products and thereby put them at a competitive disadvantage to cigarettes. As we've heard in this committee previously, people will travel to find less expensive cigarettes, and they will also not travel if there's about the same cost to them out of pocket to buy locally. So if we equalize the price between electronic cigarettes and regular cigarettes, one incentive that folks have to make the switch and get off of the tobacco products is taken away. So the Taxpayer Association of Oregon encourages no votes on both HB 2074 and HB 2134, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Benz, please.
Sure. So the assertion seems to be that if we pass this law, then people will go to the Internet, but the bill contains a ban against Internet sales. Tell us your opinion, any one of you that's had experience that way, how well that ban is going to work.
In the past, banning things on the Internet just doesn't work. Teenagers still look at pornography. People still buy things on the Internet that are not allowed to be purchased on the Internet every day. So one thing, though, as far as a tax goes locally, is you could buy pure nicotine on the Internet, which means then when people don't want to spend the money on the higher taxed items, then they can create this stuff at home, which creates a deadly poisonous nicotine in a lot of people's households that have no business using these products. It's not my place to put my own fluoride in my toothpaste. It's not my place to put my own nicotine in my e-liquid, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Those of you who are working on these solutions, you must use lab equipment.
Absolutely.
Careful measuring, those kinds of things, in order to do this. And I think you said when you first started testifying that you've managed to get yourself down to zero nicotine.
Yes, sir.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Could you give us any sense? I mean, I think you've already given us a sense about your health improvement.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard many, many people testify, either both in this committee and in other committees, about the health effects for people who are nicotine addicts, who can't quit smoking, and who have switched over to these kind of devices and have either been able to titrate themselves off, as you have, or at least have no longer are receiving other carcinogens by smoking tobacco, and they're using pure solutions. The thing that hasn't yet come up today is the issue of how we work to avoid the nicotine addiction of young people. I mean, I'm a psychologist, and one of the things that I'm very aware of from the studies and also from my experience working with patients is that that most addicts, regardless of what the substance is, become addicted when they're teenagers, sometimes even younger. Most tobacco addicts started smoking when they were in the eighth grade or even earlier. I don't know what your history is, but that's true of most people.
Mm-hmm.
ditto for alcoholics. They started using booze at a very young age. And I think the same thing is true, although to a lesser extent, for the dangerous white powders that people in our society seem to like. Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for those of us who are concerned about working to prevent the uptake of these products by young people who are not yet addicted to any of these substances, when we know that at least with tobacco products, raising the price has a significant negative effect on the willingness of young people to experiment? Any thoughts on that topic?
I'm a member of the Northwest Vapor Association, so I've had the opportunity to meet with virtually every vape shop and you know that has contacted this association. Everyone that I visited, which is well over 30 of them, have a no persons under 18 sign posted clearly on the front door. Adults only go to these facilities. It's not something that you buy at a drugstore. These are support units for places, you know, for people to go to. You know, when you purchased a nicotine product a year or two ago, and they started coming out from Big Tobacco, they were high doses of nicotine in these small products that people didn't really know about, and they were at drugstores, and people misuse these things. Now there's vape shops where people are educated in these products. They can help you to get a lower nicotine level if you're a half a pack a day smoker, to help you wean yourself off. There's no advertisements in this. It's just simply word of mouth from people that have quit smoking. The fact is, a lot of children do start smoking cigarettes at a young age. I was 12 years old when I started smoking cigarettes.
That makes you typical.
And that's pretty typical. The sad thing is, again, you know, children make mistakes constantly. You know, and parents need to be controlling a lot of what their kids do. You know, and it's up to the parents, not so much government regulation. I think that when we have these tools that actually help and benefit people to quit smoking, maybe some of these adults, possibly could be an advocate for letting a 17-year-old one pack a day smoker woman that's pregnant possibly find this alternative to be better for them. You know, so I'm not saying that these are great for kids. I'm saying that these are a tool. If it was nicotine gum, if it was the patch, or any of these other nicotine solutions that don't contain carcinogens, unlike tobacco, if it was to help a 16, 17-year-old pack-a-day smoker to quit, it wouldn't be a question, I think. But our shops absolutely, do not let minors in there. And it's, like I said, it's an adult atmosphere for adults to use these products, and it's nothing that has ever, been advertised.
Thank you very much.
Can I
yes, sir.
That? I'm Vice President of the Multnomah County Vaping Association. We recently formed to try to talk to the commissioners up there in Multnomah County. The biggest push was they wanted to get legislation through to help make it requirement for people to have to be 18 or older in order to buy vaping or related products. The law that was going into place now that I believe we're already handling on a different bill covers the idea and makes it illegal to possess electronic cigarettes. So I honestly think some of the steps are already being taken to help mitigate some of the at-risk youth that are using these. I don't think you'll ever eliminate it completely. Kids will be kids. We all know that. It's going to be a parenting side of things. But the shops already, as he stated, card religiously. Now that it's going to be a law, it'll make all other small businesses that happen to be doing this, retail chains that don't currently card, which I don't know of any specifically, but they might happen somewhere. The trick is getting it so that you're not going to have minors buying them online. So that's just a different issue. And that's where the most of the products are actually going to be found. And it has nothing to do with Oregon revenue because they're not paying it anyways. They're getting it online. They're getting it from overseas. So how that gets regulated, that's going to be another challenge to attack.
Thank you. And, of course, that provides significant labeling and quality control issues as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Colin, looks like Rao, Matt, Minahan, please. And then we'll hear from Jen Baker.
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent the Northwest Vapor Association. I'm going to be brief today and try not to be redundant. There was a lot of talk about how these taxes are going to drive folks to the internet and to the black market. What I call the garage manufacturers, which exists today. We have a lot of these guys making e-liquids out of their garage, selling these online. I've been working with the Department of Justice around Senate Bill 190, who introduced that bill, on ways to kind of control this market and eliminate the garage market. And I can also say I feel pretty confident Senate Bill 190 will move forward without the vaping component in that bill, but we're going to still continue to work with the Department of Justice. Some of the ideas that we've been coming up with is a basic registry, who the businesses are, what they're manufacturing, and then also having them adhere to industry guidelines, such as clean room environments, business registry, an actual physical location. And again, we'll continue to work with them on that. And I feel any tax at this point on the industry at its early stage will just create a further gap between what they can purchase this for in the store versus online. And it will derail some of those efforts that we've been working with the Department of Justice on and, create a black market or enhance that black market and create more unregulation than regulation. And we're not an industry that is opposed to regulation. We're for sensible regulation, and we'll certainly be here and be available to work through those. And then I also just had one kind of maybe clarification on, the definition of a vaping product. And, what Will, our president, brought up, many components to these, batteries, coils, like cartomizers that aren't necessarily designed to heat the solution. Is that would this bill be taxing all, vaping products? So when we ship out a battery, is that going to be a tax component? And that's more of a question probably for your staff than we'd like kind of clarification on that if we could.
Well, you've raised an issue that we'll have to look at.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the best answer I can give.
Okay.
Right now, every time we hold a hearing, we learn about ambiguities in the language that we have, and we have to think more about what that means.
Fantastic, and that's my testimony. I'm available.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Colin Rao. Thank you, Representative Barnhart, and members of the committee, for your time today. Again, my name is Colin Rao. I'm the owner of Emerald Vapors in Eugene, Oregon. We have four operational stores in Oregon, and we're working on our fifth store actually here in Salem. My company employs about 30 people right now in manufacturing, retail, wholesale distribution, and wholesale distribution of e-cigarettes. I was one of the pioneers in Oregon, and as a result of that, I've become pretty well known in Oregon as a businessman and as somebody who's helped a significant amount of people switch to vapor. And I don't want to sound like a broken record here, because you've heard a lot of the same things that I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Taxing e-liquid would do a number of things. It would drive the sales to the internet. People would begin purchasing these products online. They would go across the river to Vancouver to purchase them, and the already existing black market for e-liquid would grow substantially. In fact, and the black market for this stuff is kind of what worries me almost the most, and that is that the products that come out of these garages and basements and wherever, they're not using appropriate lab equipment, they're not clean areas, it's dirty and it's not done right. They don't follow any kind of procedures or anything like that. So obviously my business would suffer a great deal if these products were taxed, if it, and it may ultimately mean that I would be put out of business, and most likely would. And one of the things I really wanted to point out, and I think Will already did, is if the intention of this bill is to replace revenue loss from cigarettes, I would urge you to consider the consumption cost ratio of e-liquid when you compare it to cigarettes. A typical vapor would purchase 15 milliliters per week at a cost of about $10. A typical smoker will purchase one pack of cigarettes per day at a price at a cost of $7 a pack, or about $49 a week. To effectively replace that revenue, the tax burden on e-liquid would be so high, it would drive the market out of Oregon. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to try to replace that loss of revenue with e-liquid. And that's all I really have, you guys, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I want to make simply a comment on your last set of remarks. There are a variety of reasons why different legislators may want any particular bill, but I can tell you why I'm interested in having high cost for cigarettes and tobacco products is because it tends to discourage young people from starting to use them. And if we can discourage young people from starting to use them, we can significantly reduce the addiction rates. And if we reduce the addiction rates, we reduce the number of people in society who smoke. And if we reduce the number of people in society who smoke, we end up with much lower health costs and much less of the health sequelae of significant tobacco addictions. And you know what they are, everything from heart disease to a variety of cancers and, of course, a variety of lung disorders. Every single one of us knows at least one person, maybe several people, who have died as a result of tobacco-related injury or illnesses. For me, the revenue has always been secondary. It has been a less important piece than the health issue, than trying to have people lead healthy lives and do better. If we could end up with a situation in which there was no revenue from tobacco because nobody smoked, that would be fine with me. And the reality is that Oregon would save money because our health care costs would decline precipitously, and the money that we currently derive from other sources in order to support health care in Oregon, much of that money would not be needed. So other legislators may have other reasons why they think tobacco taxes are useful. That's mine. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Is Jen Baker here? Yes, please.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker, testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. I will be brief in my comments, but I did want to touch on the public health aspects and benefits of strong taxation policy on tobacco and nicotine-related products. ONA represents over 13,000 nurses, nurse practitioners, and nursing students who work in nearly every segment, if not every segment, of Oregon's healthcare system. And our members have a long and strong history of working on tobacco and nicotine prevention efforts. And that work has recently expanded into regulations around electronic cigarette products because, as we've heard today, there is a lot of confusion about whether or not these are healthy products. ONA recognizes that they are not as harmful as traditional cigarettes because they do not have smoke. However, we align with the World Health Organization's recommendation that we regulate e-cigarettes and those products the same way as we regulate traditional cigarettes in lieu of proof that they are not harmful to the public. And for ONA, that really means taxing these products like we do tobacco and traditional cigarettes, because we know that taxation is the strongest deterrent from having youth begin to use these sorts of products, because they're particularly price sensitive demographic of the market. So nicotine is a terribly addictive substance. It's harmful to the heart, to arteries, and brain development. And I will highlight that there are 7 FDA-approved cessation methods, and e-cigarettes is not one of those. As direct care providers, organs, nurses really urge folks who are looking to stop using nicotine to use the FDA-approved cessation techniques in lieu of e-cigarettes, which do, you know, contain a number of carcinogens within the liquid. And because it is not regulated, there really is, here in the state of Oregon, there really is no black market. There's no regulation of how these products are currently sold. We are also supportive of other bills around this, but we urge you to, in your consideration of this bill, focus on the benefits of the taxation policy and continue to engage in the other conversations through the appropriate bills that have been introduced in the legislature.
Hey, thank you. Questions? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was an interesting article in The Economist magazine about this issue, commenting on a study out of College of University of London, which suggests that in the study, 61% of e-cigarette users were able to cut their consumption in half. I guess the issue is one of getting this taxation policy right, so that on one hand we don't let kids smoking, but on the other we don't discourage folks from switching. Have you guys taken a position on that?
We don't. ONA doesn't currently, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, ONA doesn't currently have a policy that specifically outlines the best way to tax the e-cigarette policy or e-cigarette products. We do recognize that having that balance is important, because some folks are using these in lieu of traditional cigarettes, but have not gone as far as to take a stance on what that balance should be.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just impressed. But this is one of the first. This is not a perfect set of studies, but it's the best one these folks think that we've got so far, and it does suggest that there is there's validity to those that have appeared before us saying that this helped them quit or at least slow down. That seems to be something we sure want to encourage. So I think we had this conversation before, but it would seem to me that organizations interested in that would help us out by prompting us in the proper direction. That's because it doesn't seem fair to, I know the same group of people suffering from the inability to quit, and I was struck by the first part of this article, which indicates that fewer than 5% manage to stay clean for a year or more. They're trying to quit.
When was that article, Representative?
I'm going to make a gift of it to you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. You can see me frantically looking it up. December 20th, 2014. Yeah. Thank you.
Anyway, your help in that area would be appreciated.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Benz, I will call your attention. I believe the American Heart Association does have a white paper that outlines their position on that balance. Again, ONA hasn't taken an official position, but that might be a good resource to look to in determining the best balance to strike there, so that we're discouraging youth from becoming addicted to tobacco and nicotine products, but still allowing adults who would like to use this as a cessation method to do so. I will again highlight it is not FDA approved at this time, and ONA's policy is that folks pursue the FDA approved cessation techniques.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on these two bills? I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2074 and House Bill 2134. Paul, I don't have anything to set over today, do I? Right. So we have another exciting day for you tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and with that, the committee is adjourned.